I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee, executive editor at Information Security Media Group. I'm at HIMSS 25, speaking with Dr. Eric Lederman, who is CEO of consulting firm Cyber Solutions MD. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Marianne. It's good to be here with you.
So, Eric, here at HIMSS, you were on a panel speaking or moderating this panel about resiliency in healthcare. What are some of the top lessons that you think the healthcare sector needs to learn from some of the most disruptive attacks that we saw recently, including last year's Change Healthcare attack, and why?
I think the most important lesson is one that's already starting to be learned based on the content of the presentations today, Marianne, and the responses from the audience. I'm hoping this is representative of a more general awareness, which is that everyone, every single organization needs to expect that no matter how perfect they think they are, that they're going to be hit, they're going to go down, it's going to be terrible. And even if they somehow manage to escape a direct hit unscathed, organizations or vendors around them are going to be hit and it's going to cause problems. You mentioned Change Healthcare. You know, that affected just about everybody in the country and every organization, none of whom in that case were directly hit other than United Healthcare and their Change Healthcare subsidiary directly, yet everybody had terrible impacts from that. So the first thing is, everybody needs to just understand that they will be hit and they need to start preparing immediately for that eventuality.
So with that said, when it comes to hospital resiliency, when a hospital is hit with a cyber attack such as ransomware and is forced to take its systems offline, that's not only disruptive to the hospital and its patients, but also the community. You know, they might divert patients elsewhere, you know, so on and so forth. What steps can hospitals take in advance to improve resilience and recovery times and to minimize that disruption?
Well, you know, it's like a 12-step program, right? So the first step, of course, is get past denial and realize, as I said a minute ago, that you're going to be hit, and get the C-suite to understand that, and get everybody involved to understand that, including the operations and clinical leaders and the IT and security folks, of course, as well. And then to get all of those folks together for a very long time. In my experience, it takes probably 2 to 3 years to pull together a thoroughgoing plan for how to get hit. Hopefully everybody has that amount of time, but you got to start sometime. There's an old saying, you know, what's the best time to plant a tree 20 years ago? What's the second best time today, right? So start today, do your planning, get everybody involved, and then start figuring out what exactly are we supposed to do when everything's out. In other words, how are we going to take care of our patients? How are we going to run our operations? How are we going to pay our vendors and our people? How are we going to communicate with each other? And then also on the technology side, what are we going to try to restore first and in what order? And what's going to have to wait? And how do we figure all this stuff out? And then drill and try to see if it actually works. These are disciplines that most organizations, in my experience, Marianne, don't yet have. They instead have plans for outages that last for minutes to hours, not weeks to months.
So now medical devices and clinical IoT are key components to the healthcare environment. How do they fit into resiliency in terms of that equation? If the IT systems are brought down in a cyber attack, does that necessarily mean the medical devices and biomedical gear is also disrupted? Are there ways that entities can sort of protect those sometimes life-saving equipment from having to be brought down?
I don't know the answer to that question, Marianne, except to say that, first off, anything that has a Windows operating system is vulnerable, and anything that has any kind of operating system is potentially vulnerable. The Windows operating systems are most highly targeted. But most medical devices do have Windows operating systems, and many of them are grossly out of date. Right, and so as a result, medical devices, or really any IoT, but in the medical environment, that's the IoT that matters most, is at risk of serving the attackers in two ways. One is to be a vector of attack, in other words, the entry point. And the other is to be a way to disrupt the organization. So if the attack comes through some other mechanism and then spreads out from the data center across the network to the endpoints, it can be extremely disruptive. And, you know, not just in terms of trying to extract ransom, but there are scenarios that keep me awake at night that are far beyond that in terms of frightening to me, at least, which is, how about ransoming an organization by an attacker that is intentionally killing patients? So let's say they're going after ventilated patients in the intensive care units, shutting off a ventilator. Or what about interfering with the large volume infusion pumps and dumping what's supposed to be chemotherapy that's supposed to be going in over several hours all at once into a patient to kill them off, or changing the settings on radiation oncology machine to, in effect, kill a patient by exposing them to huge amounts of radiation. We haven't really seen this in this country yet, but it's all possible. And, you know, if that were to happen, then we'd be talking about endpoint devices used as vectors of targeted attack to extract ransom, or maybe to kill off specific individuals who are in the hospital that a rival organization doesn't like. Maybe it's the head of a rival gang. There is so much that's possible. We need to be thinking as much as we can as though we were in the shoes of an attacker, and then prepare.
So now, during your time at Kaiser Permanente, you served as Director of Medical Informatics and National Leader of Privacy, Security, and IT Infrastructure. What are one or two most important lessons that you learned during your time there that might be helpful to other healthcare cybersecurity and privacy leaders?
Well, in terms of this topic, which is resilience and recovery, I would say that it's absolutely critical to think about what needs to happen to avoid chaos that kills patients in the event of a thoroughgoing cyber attack, such as a ransomware attack, and to think about how to avoid prolonging the chaos and, in fact, trying to shrink it. So a lot of organizations, based on what I've heard, and it's hard to get this information out of organizations that have been hit because their lawyers tell them to clam up. This is a problem, I might add. But organizations that I'm aware of, the biggest problem is that nobody knows what the heck is going on. No one knows who's in charge. There are no communication systems. The phones are down. Nothing's working except for cell phones, but nobody knows how to reach anybody else because there's no phone directory. And the leadership is apparently not there in action, or they're, you know, maybe in a bunker somewhere trying to figure out how to run things without any visibility. And then you've got IT staff that are working 24/7, IT security staff working 24/7, running around with their hair on fire, exhausting themselves without a pre-developed, organized plan, extending the outage by weeks or longer. I'd say one of the things that I learned, not from my own organization, but by asking questions of other organizations, was something as simple as trying to figure out what the rate limiting steps are in these long outages. And from what I've heard, it turns out that endpoints are probably the rate limiting step. And I'm not talking specifically about the biomedical devices in this case, although they're very important, but the desktop and laptop computers in particular. Most organizations wait, sometimes weeks, to start tackling those. And what I've seen is that in a few organizations that have taken a different approach, where they basically just re-image every single one of them immediately, that they've cut, and again, this is a small set, so I don't know how scalable this is, but what I've seen is they've cut their serious outage time, which is basically the time it takes to get back to sufficient IT being up to safely take care of patients, from weeks to maybe half of that.
What are the tips to doing that?
Well, two things. One, again, is preparation. You've got to get everybody involved. In my experience, every organization worth its salt has an emergency management team, right? They're in charge of tackling crises like building burns down, or there's a major other kind of natural disaster, earthquake, hurricane, whatever, or there's a big problem with personnel. Maybe there's a big strike, maybe there's civil unrest, you know, but they don't think about everybody shows up to work, the building's there, but the technology's out. And so they need to be brought up to speed, and then everybody else needs to be brought up to speed along with the IT and technology people. So the department heads, the physician leaders, they need to understand what's going on, and they need to develop plans that will keep their departments working. And then the hardest part is the interdepartmental workflows. How are the results going to get from the lab to the ordering clinician? How are they going to get to every other clinician that needs to see those results? What's going to happen if the elevators don't work because they're run on computers? What's going to happen to the ability to communicate? Is there a backup system when the phones are down because the network's down? Maybe there's an off-site, off-premise cloud solution that we can all access from a vendor that's got maybe a video solution that also allows for calling and chat. There are several of those. I'm not going to name any vendors. But, you know, as long as connection to the public internet can be restored quickly and solutions are put in place that rely only on a connection to the public internet, a lot can be accomplished to reduce chaos and save lives.
And finally, Eric, what else are you keeping your eyes on closely these days when it comes to healthcare sector cybersecurity issues?
The thing we all need to keep an eye on is that attacks happen, and they happen with greater and greater frequency because they work from the standpoint of the attackers. What are the attackers after? Well, the criminal gangs are primarily after money, and the state actors are primarily after data, as I understand it. They're a little hard to figure out, a little more secretive, but they tend to take data and try to stay quiet. But let's start with the criminal gangs, some of whom now work with the state actors, I might add. So the money, they get huge amounts of money. And, you know, it's not just from disrupting organizations' operations and then extracting ransom. It's also from exfiltrating data and then, you know, ransoming that or business email compromises. Just huge amounts of money flow into these organizations. We all need to understand that they reinvest a substantial percentage of their ill-gotten gains into R&D. We need to understand that our best defense today is going to be inadequate tomorrow. We need to stay ahead of where they are. It's a constant arms race. Our defense today is their study guide for what they're going to do tomorrow. And that's what I constantly am trying to figure out.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. I've been speaking to Dr. Eric Lederman. I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee of Information Security Media Group. Thanks for joining us.